after 4 o'clock, so I think if you'd like to take your seats, let me welcome you all to this first of this year's NACDOC Award winners, and that very well-deserved award is going to Professor Jeffrey Bulford, University of Maryland. Now, Professor Bulford, I've known him myself for many years. He studied his PhD under the late David Bohm, working on invaluable interpretation of quantum mechanics. And then later, he published his first book called The Interpretation of Quantum Mechanics in 1974, when he was at the University of Western Ontario. And in that, he espoused and developed the so-called quantum logical interpretation of quantum mechanics. And in more recent years, and since going to Maryland, he's become particularly enamored of what's called the modal interpretation of quantum mechanics. And in his most recent book, Interpreting the Quantum World, which was published in 1997, and this is the book for which he's gaining the award, he's developed a wonderfully unified framework for looking at a whole variety, a whole spectrum of possible interpretations of quantum mechanics, of special cases of a wonderful, powerful, unifying theorem, which is the core technical thing actually in the book. So it's a great pleasure for me today to introduce Jeff to you and to ask him to give his NACDOC Award lecture with the title Reflections on the Philosophy of Physics. Professor Bull.
Thank you, Michael. First, let me say that I'm deeply honored to be giving one of the two NACDOC Award lectures here today. As Michael indicated, I was a graduate student here in the 60s, working with David Bohm on hidden variable theories of quantum mechanics, and I used to attend seminars and lectures at the LSE by Karl Popper and Imre NACDOC and John Watkins, and I picked up what philosophy I know by osmosis from those lectures and seminars. John Watkins has impressed on me that I should not give a technical talk on quantum mechanics, and I should not use any mathematics. I want to remind him of what Kant said about mathematics and natural science. He said, any particular natural science, there is genuine scientific substance only to the extent that mathematics is present. So if there's not much substance to this talk, then you can blame John. Anyway, I'm going to begin. My transparencies are sliding around here a little bit. Let me just pull these out so that they're not all on the floor. I'm going to begin with an article from the London Times. Let me get back to the microphone. It's actually the London Times from November 28, 1919. And there were several interesting things in that particular issue. I guess this doesn't work here. Mr. Balfour at Cambridge, awards to tank inventors, but also Einstein on his theory. The London Times had asked Albert Einstein to write an article for a non-mathematical audience on the special and general theories of relativity, and he had done so. And this is a brilliantly clear article on the special and general theories of relativity. Einstein starts off making a distinction between what he calls principal and constructive theories. Actually, in the particular translation, because the article was written in German, in the particular translation in the Times, which is a very poor translation, or a rather poor translation, it's called Theories of Principle. But let me that's the article in the Times, and he starts talking here about theories of principle and constructive theories. The relevant definition I've reproduced here, and let me just read that to you. He says, we can distinguish various kinds of theories in physics. Most of them are constructive. They attempt to build up a picture of the more complex phenomena out of the material of a relatively simple formal scheme from which they start out. Thus, the kinetic theory of gases seeks to reduce mechanical, thermal, and diffusional processes to movements of molecules, that is, to build them up out of the hypothesis of molecular motion. When we say that we've succeeded in understanding a group of natural processes, we invariably mean that a constructive theory has been found which covers the processes in question. Along with this most important class of theories, there exists a second, which I will call principal theories. These employ the analytic, not the synthetic method. The elements which form their basis and starting point are not hypothetically constructed, but empirically discovered ones, general characteristics of natural processes, principles that give rise to mathematically formulated criteria, which the separate processes or the theoretical representations of them have to satisfy. This is the science of thermodynamics, seeks by analytical means to deduce necessary connections which separate events have to satisfy from the universally experienced fact that perpetual motion is impossible. So the idea seems to be something like this. The starting point of a constructive theory is going to be certain hypothetically constructed elements, building blocks, out of which you synthesize more complex phenomena, more complex processes. So the process is synthetic. It's building up complicated processes like the thermal and diffusional and mechanical processes of gases, and reducing it to the movements of molecules. So you can think of it either as synthetic, building up complex processes from simpler building blocks, and the building blocks are the starting point of the constructive theory. And it's also reductive, reducing the complex phenomena to simpler phenomena. On the other hand, a principal theory is a very different kind of theory. The starting point of a principal theory consists of certain principles, certain empirically discovered principles, certain laws, Einstein says. And the procedure then is involves analysis. It's analytic as opposed to synthetic. The idea is to come up with a theoretical framework which underwrites these principles. The principles might even be in conflict, as they are in the case of relativity theory, as I'll indicate in a moment. And the point of a principal theory then is to come up with some abstract structural constraints on events, some theoretical framework which can be described as doing that sort of thing, which will underwrite and reconcile the principles that are the starting point. In the case of relativity theory, Einstein says there are two principles: the principle of relativity and the principle of the constancy of velocity of light. Now, as Hermann Bondi puts it, the principle of relativity basically says that velocity doesn't matter. It's the principle of Newtonian relativity, the principle of relativity associated with Newtonian mechanics, that is extended from mechanical phenomena to electromagnetic phenomena, phenomena involving light as well. In the case of classical mechanics, velocity doesn't matter in the sense that if you have different systems which are moving at constant uniform relative velocity to each other, the laws of physics are the same in those two systems, the laws of mechanical motion. And the special principle of relativity extends that to light as well. So, for example, it makes no difference whether one is playing tennis or tossing a ball on Earth or on a moving transatlantic flight, or rather, perhaps more realistically, seeing that one won't be throwing tennis balls around on a transatlantic flight, pouring a drink is the same thing as doing it on Earth, unless the plane accelerates when you hit some turbulence, and then, of course, things go wrong. Or talking, which involves sound waves through the air, is the same on a moving plane as it is on Earth. Einstein extends that principle to phenomena of light. The other principle that is the starting point for relativity theory, he says, is the principle of the constancy of velocity of light in vacuum. And as Bondi puts it, that amounts to saying there's no overtaking of light by light in empty space. Another way of putting it is to say that the velocity of light is a constant independent of the velocity of the source of the light or the velocity of the observer. These two principles entail that there's going to be a difference in the Doppler effect for light and for sound. In the case of sound, which involves a medium, the air, which carries the transmission of sound, the interval of reception of a sound signal, the ratio of the interval of reception to the interval of transmission, is going to depend on the relative velocities of the transmitter and the receiver, and the relative velocity of the transmitter and receiver is relative to the air. That is, it depends who is moving relative to the air and who is stationary relative to the air. In the case of light, that's not the case. There's no medium of transmission for light like the air. On Einstein's theory, there is no ether. And so the relative velocity depends only, the interval of transmission to the interval of reception, or the ratio of the interval of reception to the interval of transmission, depends only on the relative velocity of the transmitter and receiver. Now, it turns out that one can show fairly quickly from that the elapsed time between two events for two different observers is going to depend on the clocks of the two different observers. And as a consequence of that, the spatial distance that two observers who are traveling at different uniform velocities relative to each other, the spatial difference is going to be depend on the initial observer who's assigning the distance. So the net effect of all that is that what Einstein comes up with as a way of reconciling those two principles, the principle of relativity and the principle of the constancy of velocity of light, is a change in the kinematics of classical mechanics, a change in the relations between space and time and motion. And the outcome of all that then is to involve a change in the dynamics as well, change in what one has to say about forces and masses, and eventually you get Einstein's famous equation equals mc squared. Einstein says in order to properly grasp the nature of relativity theory, he says in order to properly grasp its nature, you have to see relativity theory as a principle theory in roughly the sense in which I've outlined, and not as a constructive theory. It's not about beginning with certain elementary building blocks and synthesizing some complex processes out of simpler processes. It's a theory which involves an attempt to underwrite and reconcile these two principles, and the way Einstein does it is to change the kinematics of classical mechanics, arriving at relativity theory. Mathematically speaking, it involves a change in the geometry of space-time, a change from the Euclidean geometry of classical mechanics to a different geometrical structure, a Minkowskian geometry. Well, from the London Times, I want to move to the New York Times. New York Times of July 28, 1935. And that issue of the New York Times has an article about the big controversy between Einstein and Bohr about quantum mechanics. Actually, the paper indicates that that's when the controversy began. So if you want to know when the controversy between Einstein and Bohr began, it began on Sunday, July the 28th, according to the New York Times. But what it says, I'll just read you the first couple of paragraphs. It says, "The world of science is watching with the keenest interest the development of a modern controversy which promises to take its place along with the other historic controversies in the realms of philosophy and physics, philosophy and science, sorry. Participants are Albert Einstein and Niels Bohr. Two men have achieved the rare distinction of having joined the ranks of the immortals during their lifetime. The subject concerns the fundamental nature of physical reality, the problem of problems which has engaged the minds of all great philosophers, poets, and scientists throughout the course of human history. The Einstein Bohr controversy has just begun this week in the current issue of Nature, a very scientific publication, with a preliminary challenge by Professor Bohr to Professor Einstein, and with a promise by Professor Bohr that a fuller development of this argument will be given in an article to be published shortly in the Physical Review. Undoubtedly, Professor Einstein will accept the challenge, and very likely Professor Bohr will answer, and there's the possibility that other leading scientists will enter the arena. Well, it sounds more like a wrestling match at that point, actually. But what was this controversy about? Well, the controversy began with a paper in 1935 by Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen. And that's also from the New York Times. Einstein attacks quantum theory. Scientists and two colleagues find it's not complete, even though correct. This report is actually a leaked report by Podolsky, one of the authors of the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper, to the New York Times. Podolsky actually, it turns out, wrote the paper and gave this interview to the New York Times. Einstein didn't like it at all, actually. He didn't like the fact that Podolsky had given an interview to the New York Times, let alone that it had been leaked. And in fact, there's a rather acerbic comment from Einstein, statement by Einstein, rather, a little later. This was about 3 or 4 days later in the New York Times. Statement by Einstein. I just thought I'd show you this because it's sort of amusing. Dr. Albert Einstein has sent the following statement to the New York Times. Any information upon which the article Einstein Attacks Quantum Theory in your issue of May the 6th is based was given to you without my authority. It is my invariable practice to discuss scientific matters only in the appropriate forum, and I deprecate advance publication of any announcement in regard to such matters in the secular press. So that was Einstein's view. Well, I want to go from, before talking a little bit about what that controversy was about, I want to move from the New York Times to Physics Today. Actually, the journal Physics Today, February 1999. There is the same controversy. That particular issue has a bunch of letters on the interpretation of quantum mechanics. Observant readers take the measure of novel approaches to quantum theory. Some get bohmed. The series of letters the occasion for the series of letters was an article by Sheldon Goldstein in a previous issue of Physics Today, where he discussed a variety of interpretations of quantum mechanics, in particular Bohm's, and attempted to deal with the same issues that Bohr and Einstein had discussed in 1935. And in this particular issue, as the fallout from that particular article, you have a series of prominent physicists taking issue with Sheldon Goldstein's remarks on this issue. Now, I think it's curious that we're still talking about these things today, these issues that Bohr and Einstein discussed in 1935 and earlier. It's actually rather remarkable, I think, that there's been no resolution to these questions about how to understand quantum mechanics, how to understand the transition from classical to quantum mechanics. People are generally in agreement about how to understand the revolution involved in relativity theory, but in the case of quantum mechanics, there seems to be no general agreement. At least the issue is still controversial. Well, let me try and bring out a little bit about why I think that's the case. And I want to begin by explaining a little bit about how one gets from classical to quantum mechanics. In the case of in the case of quantum mechanics, It began with Heisenberg's matrix mechanics in 1925. And before that, there was a sort of mishmash of theories, modifications, ad hoc modifications of classical mechanics to accommodate experimental data of various sorts. And perhaps the primary theory at the time amongst those sort of quasi, among the early quantum theory, as it's called, was Bohr's theory of the atom. And in that theory, you have a picture of the atom as along the following lines. You have a central nucleus, and you have electrons which move around the nucleus in orbits. Now, on the classical theory of electromagnetism, Maxwell's theory, if an electron is going to be orbiting around a nucleus, a negatively charged electron around a positively charged nucleus, it's going to radiate. And the frequency of the radiation, it's going to radiate light, and the frequency of the radiation on the classical theory is going to depend on, the frequency of the orbit in the following sense. If one considers a general non-circular orbit, one can Fourier analyze it into a fundamental mode and a bunch of higher harmonics. That's quite analogous to considering a string which is vibrating. And one can also represent the frequencies of the vibrations in terms of a frequency of a fundamental mode and various higher harmonics in which the string vibrates. And it's a feature of that classical theory that the frequencies of the higher harmonics are all just integral multiples of the frequency of the fundamental mode. So what you would expect on the classical theory of electromagnetism for the electron going around a nucleus is that the frequencies of light emitted would just depend on the would just be integral multiples of the fundamental mode of each particular orbit. And what you find is something quite different. You find that if you had that in classical mechanics, the electron would actually spiral into the nucleus, and that definitely doesn't happen as it loses energy. What you actually find is that the orbits are stable, and an electron emits radiation when it jumps from one orbit to the next orbit. And there's a formula, which Bohr came up with, for the frequency of that radiation, which is just proportional to the energy difference of the two orbits between which the jump occurs. Now, it's also the case that when you consider orbits which are very far from the nucleus, that you get that the frequency law, Bohr's frequency law, reduces to the classical law, in the sense that for orbits which are very far out, if an electron makes a jump from one orbit to an adjacent orbit, it will give out a frequency which is the same as the fundamental frequency, and when it jumps to orbits which are further in, the frequencies will be the frequencies of the successively higher harmonics. That's called the correspondence principle. So what you have are two principles, Bohr's quantum postulate for the frequencies of the light emitted, and the second principle, which is the correspondence principle. Here's a picture of the frequencies. What you would expect on the classical theories are frequencies which are just all integral multiples of fundamental frequency. What you find are frequencies which are quite different, except for orbits which are very far out, in which case you get something like this again. So what Heisenberg was faced with was a problem of coming up with a theory which gave you these two principles. And there were different ways of looking at the problem at the time. One way of looking at the problem was that Well, Bohr's theory gave you a sort of recipe for calculating these frequencies, but it didn't actually give you any mechanism for the transitions themselves. So one might suppose that what you ought to look for was a theory which came up with some such mechanism. And actually, at the time, there was a dispute about which way to go, as is described by Tamanaga in his book on quantum mechanics. Tamanaga says, nevertheless, this procedure, Bohr's procedure for coming up with the frequencies of radiation, is to be considered as merely a convenient recipe for calculating quantum theoretical quantities such as transition probabilities, probabilities of a jump from one orbit to another, since we do not know the cause of the quantum transition. When we arrive at the true theory, the first thing to be clarified is the mechanism through which only a certain discrete set of states can occur in nature, and then to understand what determines why some atoms jump from A to B at time TB, while others jump from A to B prime at time TB prime, and so on. We'd then be able to calculate the frequencies of occurrences of such transitions, and presumably we would find it's actually in harmony with the correspondence principle result in the limit of large N. The limit of large N is these orbits which are far out. It's very natural to anticipate such a future for the quantum theory. However, in applying the correspondence principle to various problems, a group of physicists with Bohr as leader began to think differently. Namely, they began to realize that the nature of the discontinuities or of the transitions should be sought in the correspondence principle itself, and that there are no ad hoc fundamental laws which have no correspondence to the classical theory. According to the viewpoint of common sense, a hidden mechanism is to exist to make the states continuous, and there should be laws of a more fundamental nature which describe the course of a transition, but this viewpoint should be abandoned. The correspondence principle so far described is still too vague in its formulation, but following Bohr, it's anticipated that the correct laws of the quantum world should be attained not by introducing certain additional laws for the transition mechanism, but instead by a revised form expressed mathematically in a clear-cut way of the correspondence principle itself. And that's what Heisenberg looked for with quantum mechanics. So Heisenberg began with the two principles, the quantum postulate, Bohr's frequency condition for the radiation emitted by an atom for small values of n, so that is orbits close to the nucleus, and the correspondence principle for large values of n. And beginning with these two empirically discovered principles, he arrived at a theory of motion in which the representatives of certain classical dynamical variables do not commute. Now, that is to say, he solved something like a cryptographic problem. I mean, he said, look, I've got classical mechanics and classical electromagnetic theory, and I've got these two principles. How can I fiddle with things in order to get those principles to come out in the end? And what he found was that what you had to do was change the kinematics of classical mechanics in this rather strange way. You had to take classical quantities like position and momentum and replace them with mathematical representatives which don't commute. That is to say, position times momentum is not equal to momentum times position. With that change, he was able to accommodate both those two principles. Now, you get a very peculiar theory then, naturally. And physicists and philosophers of physics have been arguing ever since Heisenberg's theory in 1925 about how to understand this. Fairly shortly after Heisenberg came up with his non-commutative matrix mechanics version of quantum mechanics, Schrödinger came up with a much more familiar sort of mechanics, wave mechanics. And the wave mechanics gave exactly the same answers for the transition probabilities and frequencies and so on as matrix mechanics, but it was much more familiar to physics. In fact, it looked much more like a constructive theory, because Schrödinger's view initially was that the way to understand the processes going on in an atom was to think of, to introduce new sorts of building blocks and construct the processes, the more complicated processes, out of these building blocks. And the building blocks which Schrödinger introduced in his wave theory were standing waves of a certain sort. That's a very different picture from the much more abstract picture of Heisenberg's theory. Schrödinger proved that the two mathematical formulations, the two theories, were equivalent mathematically. And this initial proof of equivalence was developed in a much deeper way by people like Dirac and von Neumann into the full-blown theory of quantum mechanics. Now, at this point, one can look at the new theory of quantum mechanics either as really a sort of a sophisticated wave theory, which would mean looking at quantum mechanics as a constructive theory in which the elementary building blocks are waves. That is, one can say, well, really, Schrödinger's picture is the fundamental sort of way of looking at things, and the Heisenberg more abstract theory, well, that's just sort of mathematically equivalent, and it's of no real significance. Or one can look at it the other way around. One can say that, well, the equivalence of matrix and wave mechanics really means that the fundamental picture is the matrix picture. The fundamentally new step in going from classical to quantum mechanics is something to do with non-commutativity, and that the fact that one can represent things mathematically in terms of waves, well, that's just an artifact of the mathematics. Well, part of my thesis today is that the way to understand quantum mechanics is really to see it as a principle theory in Einstein's sense. That is that Heisenberg's theory is really the fundamental theory, and the fact that one has a wave formulation is not of fundamental significance. Now, I'm going to have one transparency which is a little mathematical. And what I'm representing here is the way I think one should understand Heisenberg's theory, or Heisenberg's version of quantum mechanics, as a principle theory. Classically, to say that the quantities like position and momentum don't commute, that one has a theory in which certain quantities don't commute, is equivalent to saying that the properties of the theory, the property of being in this room, the property of having a momentum in a certain range or velocity in a certain range, the property of having energy in a certain range, those properties, classically speaking, are represented by sets. And a classical state is represented by the minimal possible set, that is a point, essentially. And so one would represent two properties, P and Q, classically by sets, subsets of a big set. When one goes from classical to quantum mechanics, the significance of non-commutativity is that one replaces the set representation of properties by the representation of properties by the subspaces of a space. And that gives you a different kind of structure. So my picture represents going from sets, P and Q, to subspaces, P and Q. And you have a new element of structure, the angle between subspaces. And that there's no corresponding notion in the representation of properties by sets. And that angle is interpreted quantum mechanically to do with probabilities. So formally speaking, you go from a Boolean algebra of subsets of a set for representing properties to a non-Boolean structure called a lattice of a certain sort, which is generated by the subspaces in quantum mechanics. And what that means is that and, or, and not, the way you conjoin properties classically, which are associated with set intersection, union, and complement, get associated with subspace intersection and subspace span and subspace orthogonal complement. Classically, a classical state is then just a catalog of properties, all the properties that the system has. Quantum mechanically, there is no selection of possessed properties versus non-possessed properties, which you can select, even mathematically speaking, out of the representation of properties as subspaces. And that's the root of the interpretation problem in quantum mechanics. Let me try and bring out something of the flavor of the peculiarities of quantum mechanics. Little bit with a couple of pictures here. The way you represent, if you're going to have a non-commutative theory, it turns out that you're going to use minimal non-commutative theory where properties are represented by subspaces, you're going to use minimal subspaces to represent states. That seems the natural thing to do. And these would be lines or vectors, one-dimensional subspaces. So the way you would represent something like a particle in a box is by a state in the box represented that way. But these states are vectors in Hilbert space, or lines in Hilbert space. Outside the box, you'd represent it by a state like that. But now, because the states can be added linearly, one can also have a state which is 1 over root 2 in the box and 1 over root 2 out of the box, where the squares of the 1 over root 2s represent probabilities. So that would represent a situation which the particle had a probability of a half of being found in the box and a half of being found outside the box. But in some sense, it's neither. It's not in the box and it's not out the box. It's something in between. And this is a peculiar kind of so-called superposition state that one can get in quantum mechanics. And that's directly a consequence of this non-commutative theory. Now, you can also get more complicated things than that.
If you had Alice and Bob, both have boxes, both are looking at particles in boxes,
you can either have the two particles both in the box or the two particles both outside the box. But now you can also have a state where you have something, again, in between, a complicated superposition of the particles being neither in nor outside the box. One would interpret this as follows, that the probability is half of both particles being in the box and half of both particles being outside the box. But such a state cannot be interpreted as just a measure of ignorance of whether or not both particles are in the box or both outside the box. It's a genuinely new kind of state. Schrodinger regarded this feature of quantum mechanics, these entangled states, as the essential feature of quantum mechanics, and I think that's quite right. He says, when two systems of which we know the states by their representatives enter into temporary physical interaction due to forces between them, and when after a time of mutual influence the systems separate again, then they can no longer be described in the same way as before, namely by enclosing each of them with a representative of its own. I would not call that one, but rather the characteristic trait of quantum mechanics, the one that enforces its entire departure from classical lines of thought. By the interaction, the two representatives, or the states, these are these states that I've represented, the psi functions, have become entangled. So one speaks of entangled states in quantum mechanics, and these entangled states are precisely the sorts of states that raise all sorts of interpretative problems about what on earth is going on with quantum systems. Let me just go back to the transparency I had on before. I started off with the London Times and then moved on to the New York Times, which referred to the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen article. I just want to explain in terms of this transparency what the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument was all about, because one could do it very simply. What Einstein pointed out is that if you have entangled states of this sort, then there's really a problem of interpretation, which goes like this. Einstein says, in a state like this, if Alice were to measure whether the particle on her side is in or out the box, she would find it definitely in or out the box with a probability of half. Well, suppose she finds it in the box. Then she can infer, seeing that the probability is half for getting in and half for getting out, that if she's found her particle in the box, for sure, Bob's particle must be in his box, because there is zero probability of getting in together with out over there. So she can infer with certainty, if she finds her particle in the box, that Bob's particle is in the box. And she can infer with certainty, if she finds her particle outside the box, that Bob's particle is outside the box. Now, Einstein argued as follows. Look, Alice is fiddling around with a particle over here, and this one is very far away. She couldn't have influenced anything over there by doing something over here. She could perhaps have influenced something over here. So if she's in a position after doing something here to be able to predict with certainty what is the case there, and that can be checked, then presumably that must have been there already, because something couldn't have popped into existence
on the basis of what Alice did here. It must have been there before. But if before Alice did anything here, the particle was either in the box or out the box, then that's inconsistent with this entangled state, because that would either be described by this state or this state, and this is a different state of affairs. And one can perform experiments which reveal the difference between this state of affairs, this state of affairs, and this state of affairs. So Einstein's conclusion was that quantum mechanics is incomplete. And this is what the big debate between Einstein and Bohr was about. What Bohr, part of Bohr's reply to Einstein's doctrine of Rosen, involved this rather interesting statement. Bohr said, of course, there is, in a case like that just considered, no question of a mechanical disturbance of the system under investigation during the last critical stage of the measuring process. There's no question of Alice doing something in her part of the world with her box, mechanically influencing Bob's box. But even at this stage, there's essentially the question of an influence, and the italics are in Bohr, an influence on the very conditions which define the possible types of predictions regarding the future behavior of the system. So what I take Bohr to be saying here is, look, you can't mechanically change the properties of that system out there, but what you can change are the possibilities open to the system. Now, it's remarkable that physicists didn't really pick up on the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen issue, which was 1935, as we saw, and nobody paid much attention to it until the 60s, when John Bell picked up the question again, and, it's apart from Bohm, actually, who came up with some interesting twists on the EPR argument, the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument. But it was only 30 years later that Bell explored this argument and showed that, in fact, you couldn't complete quantum mechanics the way that Einstein would have liked. So you have a real puzzle. I mean, Einstein, quantum mechanics appears to be incomplete, but you can't complete it. It was more than 30 years after that, in the 1990s, that it took more than 30 years for physicists to realize that this entanglement could actually be exploited as a resource. And you can do remarkable things with entanglement. You can do things like teleportation, and this is my second last transparency, because I think time's getting on. You have three boxes, say. You have Alice and Bob, who share a pair of particles in an entangled state. Now, I had before in and out, but here we consider entangled with respect to up and down in the top or bottom part of a box. So one has an entangled state of this sort, which consists of a pair of particles which are neither both up nor both down, but somewhere in neither one up and one down, but in some kind of weird quantum mechanical entangled state. Alice gets another particle, someone hands her a particle in effect, in an unknown quantum state. Now, it turns out that Alice can perform a measurement on these two particles, which she has in her hand, so to speak, and the result of this is that she, in effect, asks. I mean, she performs a measurement which amounts to asking these two particles, are you guys in the entangled state? Now, they aren't in the entangled state. This is in some unknown state, and these two are. But the result of asking such a question, by performing an experiment which asks such a question, is that they end up in an entangled state with a certain probability. And when they do, lo and behold, Bob's state is actually this state. So somehow this state gets from here to here instantaneously without traversing the space between them. More precisely, there are four possible results to this experiment that Alice can do. Only one of them will lead to the state being there. The other three will lead to a state which is related, and Alice can telephone Bob and tell him to perform a certain manipulation on the system over there and get the unknown state. So in effect, this state has been faxed, if you like, from the left side to the right side. And this is actually an experiment which has been done several times last year. This is one of the things that one can do now with entanglement. Well, let me close by going back to the article from Physics Today. because I want to ask the question, why did physicists not see all this potential in the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen article? Why were entangled states just left lying there? Because in the last few years, I guess since the 80s perhaps, entanglement has been exploited as a resource for a new form of quantum information theory, for quantum computation, which is a new way of doing computation, although that has not actually been implemented successfully except in the form of very special purpose quantum computers, which can be used for cryptography. But there have been all these incredible developments in the last few years. This is from the debate between Goldstein and other people in the issue of physics today. And this is a letter from Zeilinger, a prominent experimental physicist, who says, Sheldon Goldstein conjectures that hardly anybody truly believes anymore in the Copenhagen interpretation. And he says that this is wrong, and he and his colleagues certainly do. The Copenhagen interpretation being the interpretation of Bohr and Heisenberg. He says, I suggest that the very austerity of the Copenhagen interpretation speaks very much in its favor. And he says, in classical physics, observation is often regarded as a secondary concept, yet it's obvious that any statement about nature has to be based on observation. What could then be more natural in a theory in which observation plays a more fundamental role than in a classical worldview? What could be more sensible than the theory itself acknowledging that any statement about the physical world ultimately is at least implicitly a statement about observation? Then he talks about Schrödinger's cat, which I didn't get to, but he says that all the quantum state is meant to do is be a catalog of our observations. So the view he develops here in this letter is an instrumentalist view of the Copenhagen interpretation, and that's the way that the Copenhagen interpretation is commonly interpreted by physicists. Instrumentalism is very old. There's Osiander's preface to Copernicus's De Revolutionibus. For these hypotheses need not be true nor even probable if they provide a calculus consistent with the observations. That alone is sufficient. So this view of scientific theories, that the way to understand a scientific theory is that it's just a tool, an instrument for connecting you from one set of observations to another set of observations, is very old. And it's a very common view among physicists today. Here has been ever since the development of quantum mechanics. Here is a quotation from Van Kampen, the Dutch physicist, about the measurement problem and other interpretive problems. And he says, it's not surprising that some of my conclusions are the same as those of Bohr, inasmuch as his aim, too, is to understand how the quantum mechanical formalism works. I repeat that I shall avoid all philosophical extrapolations of the physical facts. Interpretationes non fingo. Physicists are always saying that. They're always saying, look, we're not making any interpretations. We're just going with the facts or with the observations. The puzzles that you philosophers are involved in with quantum mechanics, I mean, they all go away if we simply adopt, well, they don't say an instrumentalist interpretation, but they say if we simply stick to observations and interpret the theory as a catalog, the states of quantum mechanics as a catalog of observations, and the theory as a tool for getting one from one set of observations to the other. I think it's because of that interpretation of Bohr. I don't want to say that Bohr was an instrumentalist, but I think physicists have generally adopted an instrumentalist interpretation of Bohr and the Copenhagen interpretation. And I think it's because of that they've been so slow to see the significance of entanglement. Now I'm going to stop there with one further quote, because I think what I did not bring out clearly was the connection between entanglement and seeing quantum mechanics as a principle theory, but perhaps that can be brought up in discussion. My final quote is a quote from Einstein about this instrumentalist interpretation of Bohr. He says, if you're going to interpret physics instrumentally, then physics can only claim the interest of shopkeepers and engineers. The whole thing would be a wretched bungle.
Very much indeed, that wonderful tour of the history of modern mechanics and also issues about interpretation and philosophy and so forth. Now we've got about a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes in the discussion, and Professor Bourbon very kindly says he will answer questions. Now I think we have a sort of roving microphone that can be passed around, and perhaps anybody wanting to ask a question could state their name and their affiliation, the institution they're associated with, and then we could get some discussion started. Perhaps while you're just thinking about questions, I could set the ball rolling by asking a question myself, Jeff. You've talked, I think, rather convincingly about the role of philosophers in stimulating new developments in physics and getting people interested in entanglement and so forth. But what about the reverse influence of physics actually on philosophy? Do you think that this is something that there's a kind of two-way process going on here? Shimoni talks about experimental metaphysics and that kind of thing. Would you like to comment on that briefly?
Well, I think certainly there's a important two-way process going on here. Philosophy of physics is, it's interesting that in philosophy of science today, I think that philosophy of physics is particularly active, and that seems to be largely because of, I'm perhaps treading on some people's toes when I say I wanted to say largely because of these puzzles of quantum mechanics, but leaving out relativity, but that's largely because I think that the puzzles of quantum mechanics are just weirder than the puzzles of relativity theory. And the whole transition from classical to quantum mechanics has been so difficult to understand for physics, and has led slowly over the last 70 years or so to really rich changes in our understanding of the structural change involved. And I think that has just influenced philosophy in major ways. I mean, philosophers of physics have had to think about what physics says about logic, for example. And I think that more importantly, today, there's a very interesting revolution, I think, almost, in which is happening today in the foundations of quantum mechanics, which philosophers don't seem to have caught on to yet, but I feel that this is something that has to happen. There've been profound changes over the last few years in the physicist's conception of information. There's a big difference between quantum information and classical information. The whole notion of computation, which people in the 50s thought of as a branch of mathematics, now appears more appropriately to be thought of as a branch of physics. And I think that these changes yet have to filter down to philosophers, because something very important is happening over there with our change in the whole notion of information. And there are currently, almost technological developments in quantum cryptography, certainly, which are either on the verge of being realized or have just been realized, and this is something I think that will lead to will be a grist for philosopher's mill for quite a while.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Jeff. Now there are some people in the audience ready with questions. I think Harvey was the first one.
Harvey Brown, University of Oxford. I'd like to make a remark in relation to the principle theory, constructive theory distinction, which, as you pointed out, Jeff, is so important to understanding what Einstein was doing in special relativity. And this comes in his autobiographical notes also, when he compares the methodology of special relativity with the methodology of thermodynamics, which is the paradigm principle theory. But I have a doubt as to whether you can apply this distinction in the case of Heisenberg versus metrics mechanics versus wave mechanics. And let me just say why. If you think of the distinction between thermodynamics and the kinetic theory of gases, one, the first being a principle theory and the second being a constructive theory, it's certainly not the case that they're isomorphic. In fact, they're not even consistent. They have, as you say, they have very different methodologies. One is synthetic, and, I mean, the first is analytic, the second is synthetic. If you think of Heisenberg versus Schrodinger, you were saying that Heisenberg was really trying to create a theory around what you might call Bohr's phenomenological postulates, the quantum postulate and the correspondence principle. But they are not acting as the fundamental principles from which you devise an analytic theory. You take a mathematical structure based on matrix mechanics and then somehow bring those principles out as theorems. It's not that you're really using an analytic approach. So it's really not entirely clear to me that is an example of a principle versus a constructive theory distinction.
Well, if you look at Heisenberg's paper, the paper where he developed matrix mechanics, then it seems to me that what he's doing there is very much like what Einstein is talking about with the analysis involved in the construction of a principle theory. Einstein says, when he talks about principle theories, that the starting point of a principle theory are the principles. I mean, you begin with the principles and you ask, in effect, what must the world be like? What are the abstract constraints on events in such a way that you end up with these principles? And Heisenberg does exactly that when he develops matrix mechanics. He does start off with Bohr's theory and those two principles which he pulls out of the theory, and he literally goes step by step, and Tomonaga in his book on quantum mechanics does a very nice almost sort of step by step reconstruction of Heisenberg's paper, because this is a very unfamiliar paper in today's in terms of today's mathematics. But what Heisenberg actually does in the paper is to start off with those two principles and then say, look, what changes do I have to make to classical kinematics in order that I can reconcile these principles, in order that I'll come out with these two principles in the end? And he literally plays with these principles, fiddles about with various things, much like one would solve a cryptographic problem. In fact, Tomonaga says it's almost as if he's faced with, he knows something, he has some information, and he's trying to read the code, so to speak. And what he comes out with is a theory in which certain quantities don't commute. And at that point, he doesn't even know, as he says later, what a matrix is, because these are matrices, and he doesn't use the term matrix. But he's developed a matrix mechanics. And it seems to me that what he's doing there is exactly the process that Einstein describes as analytic. I mean, he starts off with certain principles, and he does not do what you would do if you were developing a constructive theory. He does not start off with certain kinds of structures. People have introduced the word wavicles at some point for the peculiar kinds of systems which are partly wave, partly particles, which allegedly are the way the world is, so to speak, at the micro level. He didn't look at it that way at all. What he did was he simply asked, what kind of changes can I make in classical kinematics which will give me back these principles? And in coming up with this non-commutative theory, one can see now, in terms of the way this theory is presented more abstractly in terms of von Neumann's Hilbert space account, that essentially what he was doing was something like this. I mean, this is really what I wanted to bring out. My view is this, that just as the transition from classical mechanics to relativistic mechanics involves our discovery that logic is empirical, and not only empirical in the sense that we now understand that it's an empirical question what geometry is, and geometry is not the Euclidean geometry of Newtonian mechanics, but it's actually a non-Euclidean geometry. But more than that, we've discovered that geometry is actually dynamical, that geometry is transformed and twists and gets it's malleable, so to speak, by the presence of matter in it. So geometry is dynamical. It changes with the dynamics. Similarly, quantum mechanics, the way to understand quantum mechanics, the transition from classical to quantum mechanics, is that we've discovered that we've discovered that logic is empirical. Now, logic not in the sense of logic of language, but logic in the sense of the possibility structure of events, the way in which events fit together. So we've discovered that that is empirical, that it's not a Boolean logic, it's a non-Boolean logic of a certain sort. Now, I want to go further and say that the significance of that is ultimately that we have to see possibility or modality, if you like, as dynamical, because the only way to understand this non-Boolean logical structure, if we impose certain constraints on what it means to understand it, is that we have to pull out of it at any particular time some kind of a substructure which will depend on the quantum state and will hence change from time to time. And so the substructure is going to be dynamical in that sense. It will change from time to time. And it's that substructure which corresponds to the fixed Boolean background structure of possibilities in a classical theory. So we have a dynamically changing background of possibilities against which what is actually the case is picked out at any particular time. I think this is the ultimate significance of Heisenberg's matrix mechanics. It's the ultimate significance of seeing the transition from classical to quantum mechanics as involving a principle and not a constructive change. I said that Schrödinger's theory initially was taken as a constructive theory, and that's the way he saw it initially, and that's why it was so attractive to people at the time when it came out. But actually, that particular interpretation couldn't be sustained the moment one considers more than one particular system, interacting systems. Then you have waves in an abstract space, you don't have waves in real space-time, and so Schrödinger himself dropped that initial way of looking at his own theory. So it looked like initially you had a wave theory which you could interpret as a constructive theory, but it turned out that didn't actually work. So the equivalence of the two theories, mathematical equivalence as formulated in Hilbert space quantum mechanics later, really means that we have to come to terms with quantum mechanics as a principal theory, and we have to understand the nature of the change that that has taken place. I think that just to add a couple of remarks to this long answer to your question, I think that there was a difference in the way that Heisenberg and Bohr interpreted this change. I think they both saw quantum mechanics as a principal theory, but in slightly different ways. And Heisenberg seems to have been somewhat browbeaten by Bohr into accepting his way of looking at the theory. If you look at the way Heisenberg develops the theory in the original paper, there's quite a different voice there to the way it comes out after the uncertainty principle paper, which was Bohr was following that paper. Really, Bohr had a lot of influence on the way Heisenberg saw the theory. There's an interesting play in London at the moment, Copenhagen, which I saw the other night, and describe some of that conflict between Bohr and Heisenberg.
Well, I think we have time just really just for one more question. So, Craig, would you like to?
Yeah. Craig Callender, the LSE. Just following up on Harvey's question. I thought the point you were going to make when you brought up the principal constructive distinction was the following, that just that on some interpretations of quantum mechanics, say Bohm's theory or your interpretation, the quantum mechanical formalism is to the what the world is really is according to your interpretation, like the relationship between thermodynamics and classical mechanics or kinetic theory. That is, thermodynamics is a sort of phenomenal formalism describing, you know, at a higher level what's really going on. Same thing on certain interpretations. The quantum mechanics and its operator formalism is a phenomenal formalism describing what's really going on. There's all the changing determinate values of systems. Whatever the preferred R is, the preferred observable is in your book, or position in Bohm's theory. And I'd like you to comment on that point, whether you do think the two are the same. I mean, whether you do think that sort of analogy goes through. And then I was going to make the further point, which was there's a sort of nice symmetry between the two, because if you think of relativity as Einstein's relativity as a principal theory, and then and the quantum mechanics its operator formalism as a principal theory, you can then see the constructive completions of these principal theories as there's an interesting relationship between the two, because on some interpretations, the ones where you would think of the operator formalism as just a phenomenal formalism, and certain completions, there's modal interpretations with dynamics or Bohm's theory, you end up requiring the constructive theory for relativity. That is, it seems like it's not compatible with the principle of relativity at the principle level, but then you end up requiring something like the Lorentz interpretation, which is something, you know, Harvey's worked on a lot. And you see this kind of nice symmetry between the two. But the two great revolutions, both revolutions only at the level of principle, and then both of them requiring some sort of constructive completion.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You should have asked two questions. I'm not quite sure that I understood the first question.
Talk about Shelley Goldstein's a little bit. He always makes the analogy that he thinks quantum mechanics is like quantum mechanics is to Bohmian mechanics as thermodynamics is to classical mechanics. Ah. And I was wondering if you would. And I was thinking, and that seems like a clear sort of principle constructive.
Okay, I think I see. No, I wasn't looking at it like that at all, because I think that. I'm not looking at quantum mechanics versus or various interpretations of quantum mechanics compared, say, Bohm's theory versus some other interpretation of quantum mechanics, and using the principal constructive distinction to refer to those theories, as one might talk about thermodynamics as a principal theory. Let me say this slightly differently. I see that the point of Einstein's distinction between principal and constructive theories this way. He says that most theories in physics are constructive theories, so a few theories are principal theories. This century we've had two sort of profound fundamental principal theories. So if we want to understand these theories, I mean, I'm claiming that quantum mechanics should be understood as a principal theory, and Einstein is claiming that relativity should be understood as a principal theory. Einstein says to properly grasp the nature of relativity theory, you have to see it as a principal theory. To properly grasp relativity theory, one has to see what's involved in a new way of looking at space-time. A new way of understanding geometrical relations between events in that sense. And the thesis of my book is that one has to, or at least to say, is one thesis. The thesis of the book is that to properly grasp quantum mechanics, to properly grasp the nature of the revolution, one has to see quantum mechanics as a principle theory too. So then it becomes a question, okay, well, what sort of a principle theory? In what sense? And then it involves, and the answer to that question involves saying, okay, well, how was the theory developed? I mean, how was the theory born? What were the initial principles? And what was the move made in order to provide some kind of theoretical framework which underwrites and reconciles these principles? And when you see that, well, what the move involved was to replace certain the representatives of certain classical mechanical dynamical variables, to replace them with mathematical representatives which don't commute. You see, that's the essential move. Then you have to ask, well, what's the significance of that? And I think there's von Neumann put it very clearly. In fact, in an unpublished, I should have brought that transparency too, perhaps, but I don't have it with me. Von Neumann, in an address to a mathematical congress in Amsterdam, I forget the year, but in the 50s, I think, 54 or 53, he says that, look, the significance of non-commutativity is essentially what I was trying to get across with that diagram with sets versus subspaces. He said you go from sets to subspaces. And going from sets to subspaces means that you have a new element of structure, the angle between these subspaces. And so, this angle cashes out as probability. But probability then is something which is logical in some way, because it has something to do with the structure, the way in which events are now being represented. And that then is the whole underlying question of how to understand quantum mechanics. So the answer, I see quantum mechanics as a principle theory in this sense. I mean, or at least putting it differently, this is the significance of looking at it as a principle theory. What exactly is the nature of the change from classical to quantum mechanics? And I think that if you see quantum mechanics as a principle theory, then you tend to answer the question this way. The nature of the change is that the way in which properties fit together is different classically and quantum mechanics, different in classical mechanics and quantum mechanics. And now that's actually more of a problem than that initiates the problem of interpretation, because then the question is, well, what on earth does it mean to have properties represented in this way? And that brings up a whole host of interpretative questions. So that's the starting point, not the end point of the interpretation problem. In fact, I do actually have one transparency from von Neumann here, which is not the one that I was talking about, but a letter that he wrote in 1945. I won't quote the whole letter, but what it says, it's a letter of apology. This is from von Neumann. It's also from the von Neumann archive somewhere. He says that he spent a lot of time thinking about quantum logic and how to understand this, and he doesn't know what to say, so he can't write the paper, and he apologizes. But it indicates that he struggled with this question. He saw this as the fundamental question, and he had lots of ideas about it, but he didn't think he had gotten it straight enough to actually write a paper. So this is the point of treating quantum mechanics as a principle theory. The thesis is that this is the problem of interpretation.
At this point, I think I must intervene that the discussion could go on in this fascinating way for a long time, and no doubt will run for many years to come on these questions. But I want to ask you now to join with me in thanking Professor Brook for a wonderful example of a Lakatos Award lecture. I think it's been a wonderful experience listening to it, and we thank him all very much for giving the lecture.
Thank you.
Now, I just have a quick announcement to make. There's going to be a break for tea until 5:45, when Deborah Mayo's lecture will take place in this lecture theatre. So you've probably just got time to rush up to the cafeteria on the fourth floor, or to
Wright's Bar, which is recommended to me just in Houghton Street outside the main entrance to get a quick cup of tea, but be certain to be back not to miss the second Lakatosh Award lecture, 5:45.